It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harbell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harbell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and Let's Talk Legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harbell & Collins Attorneys at Law here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. You're invited to call in, not only the 800 number, but our local numbers too, 247-7282-353-4674. And Cecil Harbell and Wes Collins are in the studio. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
How are you?
We're good.
Doing well.
All right. We were talking about guardianship last week.
Well, Ben, we have. We've spoken about guardianship several times here on the program because we are confronted with that area of the law quite often. And just very briefly, we so many times talk about how we want our clients to have a durable power of attorney so as to hopefully avoid a formal guardianship proceeding. After all, a guardianship proceeding is a proceeding where someone is appointed the guardian, the agent, if you will, the person in fiduciary responsibility to someone who is unable to handle their own affairs. But today, Wes and I want to talk about, let's assume that we have a guardianship, that it has been determined that that is what is in the best interest of the family and that that proceeding has occurred. And now what? Let's talk about some of the procedural aspects of a guardianship once, in fact, it has been granted. And also, you know, does it ever terminate?
Right.
So the first thing for our listeners to know is that there's a bond. The guardian is required to post a bond.
Oh, really? Okay.
So as to be, so that the incompetent person is assured, it's called a surety bond, so that they are assured that their assets are always protected. And therefore, if for some reason the guardian were to inappropriately use funds of the incompetent person, that person would have a third party that they would be an insurance contract where they would be able to seek recovery. So before the guardian is going to be sworn in as guardian and letters of guardianship are going to be issued, our court is going to require that that person post a bond.
Now that differs from, say, a durable power of attorney then, right?
I mean, it does. There's one of the first major differences. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so that what happens to that money? I mean, where does that go?
It's really just a policy of insurance. Usually, it could be a cash deposit. But you know, we're only going to deal with that once we've, of course, gone through the procedure and the court has made the determination that there is an adjudication of incompetence and someone is going to be appointed guardian of the estate. Now, that doesn't apply if we're just going to be appointed guardian of the person, because we're not overseeing any assets, so there's nothing to bond over.
Okay, right.
But as far as the procedure goes, since we talked last week more about the difference between a power of attorney and a guardian and a guardianship, and why you would need to potentially do a guardianship instead of a power of attorney, that's on last week's program. Then when we get to the procedure for actually going forward with the guardianship, basically what we're doing is we're filing a petition for adjudication of incompetence and appointment of a guardian. Now, this is a document that is a pretty standard statutory document. We file this before the clerk of court. The clerk has original jurisdiction over these matters.
Right.
A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people think that the clerk files,
right,
and that's all the clerk does and keeps the court
because of the word clerk,
courthouse organized. But you know, the clerk of court has some very important powers. One of which being to preside over guardianship matters and make decisions about incompetency and make decisions about who the guardian is to be. So we file this petition in the county in which the respondent, this person that we think is incompetent and needs a guardian, is the respondent, resides, where they're located. Okay. And that starts the process, of a guardian ad litem being appointed. Guardian ad litem is usually a lawyer, doesn't have to be a lawyer, but every county usually has maybe two or three or four different individuals who would potentially be selected to serve as the guardian ad litem. And that guardian ad litem basically serves as counsel for the respondent. Basically, the way the law works with regard to that is that, okay, if we think this person is incompetent, but the person has not been adjudicated incompetent yet, the person certainly has legal rights.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want, you know, a petition or someone trying to petition to have this person adjudicated kind of run roughshod over those rights. So that guardian is going to stand in a position to represent basically the best interest of that respondent.
Okay.
Now, that's a really, really
are they
important,
an advocate for that person then?
Really important issue, because mm-hmm. what's in the best interest of that respondent is not always what that respondent thinks is in his or her best interest.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons you're there, really.
Yeah, that's right. The guardian alignment, a lot of times, maybe the respondent is saying, I don't need a guardian. I don't know why we're doing this. But at the same time, mm-hmm. you know, maybe the respondent is not able to keep up with finances, not able to manage their medications, maybe getting lost wandering in the neighborhood, doing those kind of things. So then under that scenario, right. the recommendation of the guardian ad litem to the clerk would be, yes, I think Mr. So-and-so needs a guardian. It's my opinion that he is incompetent and unable to handle these matters. Therefore, this is my report to the court.
So it is a report to the court. I mean, the respondent may have their own attorney.
The respondent has the right under the statute to hire their own counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
But there still could be a guardian ad litem?
There could be a guardian ad litem. I've seen it work both ways. The statute is not that clear. It doesn't indicate that if the respondent hires their own private counsel, then there's no need
mm-hmm.
for a guardian ad litem. I've seen it work both ways where the guardian ad litem still reports to the court. I've seen a situation where the respondent hires counsel and then the guardian ad litem is dismissed.
Mm,
now,
okay.
I think I like to see the guardian ad litem in that situation
right.
because they do serve a little bit of a different role.
Yeah, a different perspective, I think, than the
That's
person.
Right.
It might be a lifelong attorney that somebody has had, and they,
right.
their relationship might be a lot more personal, maybe a little different, and this one may be more objective.
Well, that's right. And then the dynamic of the representation is different because if the private attorney is representing the respondent, then usually his or her job is going to be to advocate for what
right.
that respondent thinks is best
mm-hmm.
For himself or herself. The guardian ad litem, their job is a little different. Their job could be, you know, let's do what's in the best interest, notwithstanding what this respondent thinks is best for
mm-hmm.
himself.
A little bit more of the interest of the common good there, I think.
Yep, that's
so.
True.
So mm-hmm. that is a tricky thing. I would imagine that would be a very tough call at
yeah.
one point in time.
Well,
these are all tough calls.
They are, and we discussed that last week. These are many times, you know, highly emotional
mm-hmm.
Proceedings. They're difficult on family members. They're
mm-hmm.
difficult on the person who is, of course, potentially suffering now from some incompetency. They're very difficult for the children or grandchildren who happen to be the factual witnesses
mm-hmm.
To talk about what mom and dad are not able to do, no longer able to do, what they are doing, what they can't do. All of these kinds of issues are part and parcel of this hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then jumping around a bit, but again, once it's been determined that there is a guardian, the other difference between a formal guardianship decision and a power of attorney is that the guardian is required to make inventories,
mm-hmm.
initial inventories with the clerk of court, and then, of course, annual inventories to show what the balances are in the accounts, how the monies have been expended on behalf of the guardian, and this goes on indefinitely during the life of the guardianship. So there is record keeping on a judicial level
mm-hmm.
that is required in a guardianship. Under a durable power of attorney, we always suggest, highly recommend that, of course, the agent under the power of attorney keep good records, and most do.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no judicial requirement that that record keeping be put before the court and be audited and be determined to be in order on an annual basis.
We'll have more to come on that. What will the duties of that guardian be, and how long does it last? And more to come in just a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law. You can go online at harvellandcollins.com to listen to past shows. You can reach us right now at 800-818-2255 or one of our local numbers to ask your questions here on Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning on Coastal Daybreak. Hey, welcome back to the program. Good to have you along with us here with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law here on Let's Talk Legal. We're talking about guardianship. We had an email question that was asking, what about trusts that are held or that a respondent may have set up at some point in time? Where does that fit in?
Well, it's a good question. Trust assets, of course, are managed by a trustee, and they would be in a separate holding vessel, if you will, which is that trust. They're not individual assets of the incompetent person. They are assets that are held within the context of a trust. So
the trust is essentially its own person.
Its own person, absolutely. We talk about this and try to explain this to clients on an everyday basis, to think of a trust as kind of its own separate entity, kind of like a corporation, like an LLC, creating a different entity. Many times trusts are required to have federal ID numbers, file tax returns on an annual basis if they have certain amounts of income. If they just simply hold real property, which many trusts that we see do, just simply hold real property, then we don't need a bank account necessarily, and we're not going to need to have to file a tax return unless the property were income producing. But again, the direct answer to the question is that trust assets really are separate and distinct from the assets of the individual person who is potentially, under the scenarios we're talking about today, an incompetent person.
So the guardian has applied the bond or made that available, and also has now taken inventory. What's next? I mean, what else is the guardian required to do?
You know, back to just briefly on that trust question. You know, in order for the clerk to calculate the bond, you know, the clerk is going to want to know all of the assets of the respondent, of the ward. And usually, as Cecil was saying, those assets in a trust are going to be separate and apart, subject to the powers of the trustee as denominated and set forth in the trust. And therefore, that's not part of the whole that we calculate the bond from.
Right, right.
But you know, Cecil, I guess that we probably could have a situation where if the guardian was his own trustee, or I'm sorry, the respondent was his own trustee.
Right.
Then, depending on the language of the trust, I think it's certainly a very strong argument could be made that these assets do fall under the guardianship. So you do have to take every situation on a case-by-case basis. But I would agree with Cecil, in almost every case, trust assets of the respondent or in a trust for the respondent are going to be separate and apart and not part of the guardianship.
That's right. And of course,
the issue is really control, I think.
Right.
In our boilerplate language of all the trusts that we, of course, create, I know that it says that if for some reason the trustee named herein is unable to act as a result of, course, death, resignation, or incompetency, then the following trustee shall act, and that would be the alternate trustee. So, again, it would be important to look at the language of the trust, which is what Wes is saying, and look at the details exactly that are there. But so it's a question of fact. It was something that we would have to look at carefully.
If we're concerned about the assets of the respondent being abused in some way.
Right.
I mean, sometimes...
That's how we started this whole discussion. Really.
Sometimes that is the reason or the primary reason that we're filing the guardianship, so that we create transparency. So the court looks at the use of maybe a power of attorney, looks at the manipulation of the respondent's assets, that type thing. But if we have the same scenario with regard to a trust, depending on the facts, but in most cases, is the guardianship is not going to be the right vehicle to create that transparency with regard to the trust assets.
Right.
We would have to bring a separate action, something like breach of fiduciary duty of the trustee or something like that, where we can conduct some discovery and see how those assets are being used or abused.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be, there's a vehicle, but guardianship is not that vehicle.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Again, we kind of got started with the whole idea that somebody might be abusing some assets, and that's where the some of the guardianship questions were coming up as well.
Last but not least, Ben, you know, a guardianship is not, you know, in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
Factual circumstances can change. We've had several guardianships in our office that have tragically been the result of an automobile accident where the person for an extended period of time is unable to handle their affairs due to their accident and due to their injuries. Their child needs to come in and pay the light bills and file the tax return for that year, maintain the status quo. And then, thank goodness, the person recovers and is able to slowly but surely resume a normal lifestyle. And this, of course, in the context of a guardianship, is known as a restoration hearing or a restoring of the rights of the incompetent person.
Right.
So this does happen. Also, of course, you know, there can be other contexts. Folks can be doing very poorly due to some sort of mental disability and then become appropriately medicated again and become more stable and maybe potentially be able to have their rights restored. So it's almost similar. I hate to use the word because we do not deal in this area of the law, child custody.
Right.
But, you know, that's an area of the law that can never really be fixed in perpetuity. It's always going to be looked at if it's alleged that something different or something better or something other than is in the best interest of the children. Well, the same here. If there's some allegation of fact that's going to show that the alleged incompetent person, that it's in their best interest that their rights be restored, that facts have changed, then there certainly is going to be a door open for that hearing to be heard.
Now, I know that in many, many discussions that we've had, we've talked about backups or redundancies here, too. What if something happens to the guardian? I mean, are there provisions in that as well in the law?
Oh, absolutely. Once we're at a point where the guardian is appointed and if something happens to that guardian, then we've already gone through the process of adjudication, and that's really a huge part of making the determination as to whether a guardian is even needed.
The competency is already adjudicated.
We've already done that.
Right.
The court has entered an order indicating that there is adjudication of incompetency, and that's what we would be undoing in the event we were restoring, by the way, as Cecil was just talking about, through a formal procedure, which is the way we would have to do that. But then, in the event we don't have a guardian, then usually another family member is stepping up, a friend is stepping up. In the event the individual is wandering the streets or doing things that are dangerous to themselves or ends up in the hospital and maybe is not competent, then sometimes Adult Protective Services gets involved.
Right.
Somebody's got to start this process once this guardian is gone. I mean, it's not the lawyer. It's someone who comes to the lawyer to start that process, or it comes out of DSS, Department of Social Services. So then we would have another hearing on appointment of a successor guardian, and it'd really be just the same thing we did before. No guardian ad litem, because the guardian ad litem is really more looking at the
they've already represented what their best interests are.
My recollection under that statute is there's not a guardian ad litem appointed for that, and then a new. New guardian is appointed after a hearing before the clerk.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, you have more to come in just a moment here with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins Attorneys at Law. Lots of great information available on their website, too, at harvellandcollins.com. And you can call for that first appointment where you'll cover a lot of ground there, and that's 252-726-9050, 252-726-9050. And we'll have more to come in just a bit. We kind of got into this whole discussion of guardianship, really, about talking about abuse of someone's power, either under a power of attorney or in other aspects there as well. And what about as a guardian? I mean, if you have suspicions there.
Right. So, Ben, if we think that there there's some misuse, some malfeasance through a power of attorney, access of the respondent's money, anything that we think is problematic, but we don't have the right to get to the bank records
mm-hmm.
or get to, you know, any of the documentation that would prove that, then a whole world opens up to us once we file a petition for guardianship, because then the rules of civil procedure are at our disposal.
Mm-hmm.
We then have the right to, of course, subpoena documents. We have the right to conduct formal discovery by serving discovery requests, requests for production of documents, and the opposing party has to comply with this.
Mm-hmm.
So, or any party, and there could be multiple parties in the lawsuit or the action. So, you know, if we're making an allegation in a petition for guardianship that there has been a misuse of the power of attorney or misuse of the respondent's funds, and the clerk is going to want to see the evidence with regard to that.
Right.
Because that could be the power of attorney, the attorney in fact, could be someone who's also petitioning to be appointed the guardian.
Yes.
If we have
right.
a separate family member who's the petitioner, anyone else can come forward and say, no, I think I need to be the petitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if there's a power of attorney in place, then that attorney, in fact, under power of attorney, is really pretty high up on the priority list.
Mm-hmm.
So, however, that person falls off the priority list if they yeah. misuse the power of attorney. Well, we've got to prove it. You can't yeah. just walk into court and say, I think he's misuse mama's money or misuse daddy's money or anything mm-hmm. like that. You've got to get those bank records, get those canceled checks, credit card statements,
mm-hmm.
And prove your case with regard to that.
And just last, Ben, it is true. It came up briefly, but let's reiterate it. A lot of these cases do, you know, have their beginning with the Department of Social Services. And mm-hmm. Wes and I really want to reach out and commend mm-hmm. our local Department of Social Services and just how active they are in our community, helping people and helping families. I mean, let's keep in mind, if there's an elder person and if they're suffering
mm-hmm.
as a result of their dementia, their non-taking of medications,
right.
danger to themselves, you know, wandering the streets, these cases are reported to our local Department of Social Services, to a certain section known as Adult Protective Services,
right.
and they investigate these matters,
okay.
and they then begin to take the steps necessary to protect that person.
Call on the folks at Harvell and Collins with your legal questions, too, at 252-726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City.